Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmakers Show. So today we have an amazing founder, a founder that very recently actually, you know, like had his company acquired. And we're going to be talking about that. We're going to talk about building, scaling, financing. There is a bunch of money prior to the acquisition. But some of the stories, you know, around the journey, like founding the company, what they did during the COVID times, what was that process like of going through that acquisition, how is life post-acquisition, and many other interesting stuff. So be ready because today's episode is going to be quite inspiring. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Guy Kashtan. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
So originally born in Israel, and you grew up there in the suburbs, you know, of Tel Aviv. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Wow. So growing up, born and raised in Israel, great childhood, great people, great food, great weather. Growing up here, I think was great on all accounts.
And for you, actually, you know, like you got into the whole thing of computers, and I think it was like around the age of 4, you know, as a teenager, you were already coding. What got you so hooked into the whole thing of computers and coding?
Yeah, so from a very young age, about 4 years old, I already had my first computer, mostly gaming until the age of 13 and 14, where I started actually studying code as a hobby mostly. I built a few websites. I was actually even a professional gamer until the age of 18, mainly playing Counter-Strike. So I was mixing between school, gaming, and coding.
So then in this case for you, I mean, like anything, you did the army for about 4 years. But then once you came out of that and it was time to go to school, you did a stint in the U.S. You know, you went to Wharton, I mean, for about 6 months or so. So why the U.S.? Why not staying in the U.S.? And what happened next?
So I studied computer science in an Israeli university. And the reason why I chose that specific university, which is IDC, is for two main reasons. One is exchange abroad, specifically Wharton in the US. And the other is the entrepreneurship programs, which I actually ended up participating in both. And when getting to the US, to UPenn, I had the opportunity to study either computer science there or business. So business was more interesting to me being at Penn. And I studied a lot of interesting things, including negotiations and otherwise, which could have helped like at a later point. We'll get to that as well. Going back to Israel, I also participated in the Zelle entrepreneurship program, which taught me a lot what it would even mean to manage a startup at a later point, which we'll get to as well.
So let's talk about returning to Israel. You know, how was, you know, working for Microsoft? Because, I mean, once you got the computer science degree out of the way, then it was time to work for the bigger guns. And how was it like, you know, working with Microsoft?
So first of all, they say, and I agree, that Microsoft is a great school. So definitely learned a lot that I didn't actually learn at university. I actually started working at Microsoft while still in school. So in Israel, working part-time for Microsoft is pretty common. So I worked there for the last 2 years of the degree. And then once I graduated, I started working full-time. Initially, it was as a developer. And at the later point, as the product manager, worked there for about 4 years before founding Rewire with my two co-founders from Microsoft and one co-founder from the university.
So then let's talk about that. You know, you met your most important people, you know, in your professional career, you know, during that time, you know, at Microsoft. And walk us through what that process looked like of, you know, being there and then all of a sudden realizing like 4 years in, I mean, 4 years in, I mean, at this point you had the security, it was probably feeling good, 9 to 5, you know, you had your paycheck. Why complicating your life, you know, with venturing into the unknown?
Yeah, it was never 9 to 5, even though there is better work-life balance when you're working for a large company. So, you know, with Microsoft, I would still work with Seattle, which we'll talk about more soon. So I wouldn't say it was 9 to 5, but, and also at that part of like at that age, which was about 26, 27, security is not the main thing I was looking for. It was one, which was always interesting for us, is what type of impact can we create in the world? Second is growth opportunities. So I think when you start working at a larger company, over time, you grow, but over time it gets linear. And I still wanted to be, and I still am, on a steep learning curve. So after 4 years at Microsoft, actually, I felt it was time to do something that's challenging, something with potential impact that we can drive ourselves. And I always knew that founding a startup is something I would want to do. This is why I went to the entrepreneurship program as well. So I felt actually created enough security to take the time and not have a salary for a while. So I felt it's the right time and that I've learned enough in order to start that journey.
So then let's talk about the company. You know, let's talk about when you guys, you know, finally decided that it was about time, you know, to get going, you know, with the business. So when you got started with Rewire, you know, how were those conversations, you know, with your co-founders, you know, the chats that you needed to have for that moment to arrive where you all felt that it felt good, you know, to give the notice, that it felt good to go at it and take a step at entrepreneurship?
So giving the notice didn't necessarily feel good because I loved Microsoft, I loved the team I worked with, but it did feel exciting to be on the new path and on that journey. When we started, we looked at many things that we could do, and we talked between the co-founders at the time. We considered many, many options, and when we got to remittances, which is, again, helping immigrants and their families through sending money back home, and over time, additional financial services, that was exciting for us because for the first time, we saw a real customer with a strong need that we can support that is appreciated by that customer. And then when we took a step back to look at the entire market, at the time, we saw more than 250 million migrants or immigrants across the world sending money back home, supporting their families, and many times the heroes of their families as well, and serving that bigger purpose while also having a clear business potential was very exciting for us.
So then I guess, say, for the people that are listening, you know, what ended up being the business model of Rewire? How are you guys making money?
So at Rewire and most remittance companies, so we were always a wallet-based remittance company providing more financial services for immigrants beyond money transfer itself. But money transfer itself is the business model. So we would take a small cut of that money transfer. And when we started, our price at the time was about half of the local competitors. Over time, many competitors reduced their pricing to match and compete. But we actually had the benefit of creating a new pricing point at the market at that time and helping immigrants and their families, even if they were not even served by us, through that price reduction. But at the end of the day, in remittances, it's about the foreign exchange fee and the direct fee for the transaction.
So then in your case, you know, what were the early days like? You know, at what point do you realize that maybe you're turning a corner and that, you know, perhaps this thing has legs?
Wow. So I feel like you feel that almost every couple of months, but then you find the next challenge and then you overcome that challenge as well. I think the first time that was most exciting for you was when we just started. The first customer we had, which we helped send money, gave us an envelope of cash so that we would send that money abroad for her. When we've done that, the next day she came back with five of her friends and five envelopes of cash with handwritten with pencil on the envelopes, the beneficiary information back in the Philippines. And that for me, that's the first time that I felt not only is there a strong need, but it's also pretty viral if we provide a very good service. So that was one. And then every time you raise more and more money and grow the team and grow business. So every success along the path feels like you turn the new corner and this thing has bigger legs than previously and then expanding to Europe at a later point. So again, many, many steps along the way, but mostly through customer adoption and customer feedback. That would be probably the most exciting points where you get that positive reinforcement from the customers, either by them using the product, referring their friend, which was the majority of our growth for the majority of the years. And again, business success all the time.
So then in this case, you know, how was also the experience of going from early stage to growth stage, you know, from a life cycle perspective? Because, I mean, you guys did a couple of cycles too here, and I'm sure that was quite the journey too of going from early to growth.
Yes. So by now I've been in this industry of remittances and servicing immigrants and their families for more than 9 years. And sometimes people would ask me, like, don't you get tired in the industry, etc. So my answer is definitely no. First of all, what we're doing is important. So impact is exciting for us. And second, different areas had different challenges. So when you're just starting, in our case, with $300,000 of investment, it's a whole different ballgame where the founders do almost everything. We had like two employees for a while before we raised $1.4 million. And then you hired the first group of employees. At a later point, when we raised $2 million, we started hiring a broader team, including marketing. So you stop doing some of the things that you were doing yourselves before and you manage. At the later point for growth, you start hiring managers. Sometimes you grow the previous people that you have to become managers. Sometimes you hire people externally. And then when on our A round, when we raised about $12 million for the first time, we went from about 30 people to 80 people. This has its own unique sets of challenges, which I love having the different challenges along the path, and especially overcoming the challenges. That's obviously what we even like more.
So how was it like to put that in parallel with financing? Because I know that prior to the acquisition, you guys had raised, you know, about $62 million. So how was that too? How was going through the journey of raising money, doing the rounds, you know, going from different expectations from one cycle to the next? I mean, how was that journey too?
So when you raise money, usually there's more no's than yeses. luckily, you only need, give or take, a couple of yeses every round. So rounds are sometimes nerve-wracking. You get no and no and no. Multiple times you understand why. You either improve what you're saying so people understand it better or come back with better results as well after some period of time. So raising money was sometimes easier at the beginning when it's just you raise money based on the team and the general path, but then you raise money in initial traction. The more you get to A round or B rounds, then the expectation is more around, you know, the economics and traction and expectations moving forward. So it did become harder, but it also created more value eventually.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
In terms of the financing too, I mean, this leads me to the next question, which is COVID. I mean, as you're thinking about going through the rounds, you know, through the cycles, whether it's on the business, on the financing, ultimately COVID, you know, brought everything to a screeching halt. You know, I guess I'd like to hear, you know, like, how did you guys go about, you know, this phase and how did you guys handle the situation?
So COVID was a very interesting period for us of both challenges of moving to work from home, but also significant growth. We've seen high significant monthly growth, month-on-month growth, because our services were more digital than our competitors. And during that time, many immigrants couldn't even leave their houses, or if they were taking care of elderly people, then they couldn't leave them to the risk that they would cause them if they go out and then back. So we saw an actual boom of digital adoption, which I know many other companies in different industries have seen as well. But we've had that as well. We hired dozens of employees in a couple of months, all working remotely. It was a period of time where I didn't even meet new employees for more than 6 months.
I mean, that's crazy. So then, you know, like, obviously, that leads you to ultimately what ended up becoming the acquisition too, no? Which ultimately was the a successful outcome, especially nowadays, you know, after the incredible growth, you know, that Remitly has gone through. So how was it like, you know, going through the acquisition, you know, for you guys? Well, how did the process get started to begin with?
So it got started by Remitly reaching out to us. I have an investor that says that good companies are not being sold, they're being acquired. So ideally, you don't necessarily look for it, but it comes. And I, of course, having a venture capitalist as part of our cap table, that was the path that we were also looking at. But we've always looked at that as if we build a great company with deep technology and business growth, then at the right time, we'll have an opportunity. And that opportunity came through Remitly reaching out and starting those discussions around March 22.
And did you guys know them before? Or was it like a cold email, a cold LinkedIn message? How did it come in?
So it was a cold email, even though the person who managed M&A at the time knew one of our directors. So there was some familiarity, but it was pretty much a cold email at the time. We, of course, knew of Remitly. At the time, a leading player in the industry. And we've always felt most similar to Remitly in terms of vision and culture, even before getting to know more of the people. So when they reached out, again, one of the only players in the industry to go through an IPO as well, pretty broad in terms of financial activity, which we can cover as well. We were pretty excited about that opportunity. But we were also always told and taught that acquisitions take time. So it doesn't go from an email to a signed and closed deal within a month. It actually took almost a year from March 22 to January 1st to the beginning of January.
But was it more like a partnership outreach? What it was, you know, initially the discussion, or was it like right away into, hey, let's explore an acquisition?
It was about exploring an acquisition, which was eventually signed in August of that year. So from March to August is when we had some email exchange, then some meetings, some of them in Israel, some of them at other sites that Remitly has. And then it was eventually signed in August. However, in this regulated environment that we are working in, you also need the regulator's approval for a deal like that. And then that went from August to about January, where the deal was closed and we all became part of Remitly.
That's amazing. So for example, like as part of this transaction, when the company reaches out, I mean, walk us also, you know, for the people that are listening to really understand how something like this, you know, would pan out and how they could also implement it for themselves, no? I mean, is it like at that point you start the discussions and then you would discuss at a board level, or you wait for the discussions to progress a little bit more and then you run it through the board? Did you guys use any bankers or anything to help you? I mean, walk us a little bit more through the logistics there.
Yeah, so we didn't use any bankers. We did it all ourselves on our side. Of course, you have many people working with you, like lawyers and accountants, etc., that you need their support, but not a banker or anything of that sort. I kept our board up to date at all times. The way I see leading anything significant in a company is by being very transparent with your board of directors. So pretty early on, we decided that specific two board members would be accompanying me to most of the strategic decisions and discussions, but speaking with Remitly was mostly the founding team. And the more those discussions matured, the more people from the company we brought in. But we also didn't want to distract the company from its path of growth or even raising money at a later point, because until a deal is signed, it's not closed. And at any point along that path, what I kept telling the people that are working on the deal as well on our side, that we should look at that as 50-50. So even though there were some days we felt it's 80 and some days we felt it's 20, I kept saying that we should look at it as 50-50, because if you look at that as an 80% done deal, then you ignore the rest of the path, which was critical for us to continue managing. So on one side, pushing for the deal that we really believed in and believe in Remitly today, But on the other hand, not losing sight of our plans, which are growing and again becoming the most significant player independently.
And I know that it ended up being a stock deal, which obviously stock deals, you know, can be a little bit frightening, right? Because, you know, you have like certain visibility, you know, obviously you don't know where the future is going to go. It's not as certain as having cash on hand, no? Now, in this case, it really worked out pretty nicely for you guys because when you did the transaction, it was about 2022. And then ultimately the stock of Remitly, you know, has doubled, right? So it sounds like you guys have done pretty well. And probably at the prices, you know, or at the peak, you know, we're talking about over 160 million type of transaction that ended up happening, no? At today's value of the business. So I guess when you do like a stock deal like this, you know, that is not just cash and cash is very easy, but with stock, were there anything, you know, or any considerations or anything that you looked into to make sure that you guys were doing the right thing, taking an all stock deal?
So the details of the transactions are public, Remitly being a public company, so I prefer not to specifically talk about the terms, but yeah. I say that when you are being acquired by a company, you need to believe in the company as well. And that's the more important thing, in my opinion, and even looking at the performance of the company. So again, talking only from public reportings, so in Q4, the company had 5.9 million customers, active customers across the world, which is 41% up from the same quarter the previous year. So this is just one example of the scale and potential of the company. So again, it's about the trust in the people you work with, the trust in the company that you work with. And the more we were integrated into the company, the more that became a real end case.
That's amazing. So then the deal happens, you know, amazing, you know, outcome there for everyone. And then, well, how did the post-integration happen? You know, because obviously you're still part of the company now today of Remitly, which is fantastic, no? So I guess, how would you say that an integration like this, you know, what are some of the things that you guys have taken into consideration to make sure that that integration would succeed?
It's a great question. And I can say that I learned a lot along this path from many of the leaders at Remitly, including Josh and Matt, who are the co-founders, and my boss. And one of the first questions that Matt, the CEO, asked me when we met for the first time, what is the culture at Rewire? Which was initially a surprise to me. No one I met that had financial interest in our company in the past, the investors and otherwise, wouldn't even ask me what's the culture. But definitely wouldn't ask me that as the first question. And today, almost a year and a half into being part of Remitly, I think that our cultures like both Remitly today and previously Rewire, is probably the number one reason why the integration between the company has been as great as it was. I can share that one of the leaders of the company recently told me, a very experienced leader, told me that this is the smoothest acquisition that he has seen. Now, it's my first and only one, so I can't compare, but I can tell you how I feel, which is at home. One of the Remitly values is be an owner. And you know, for me, that feels the same as it was when we were the actual owners at Rewire. So we care about the company, we care about our mission, we believe in what we do, we believe in the people around us, and we are now actually way more empowered to be successful on the path that we were on before. So we're actually continuing the same vision and path, or similar vision and path that we had before, but with a lot more opportunities, with more people to learn from, which is mutual as well. So pretty excited about both the integration and the path moving forward.
So let's say now I put you into a time machine, Guy, and I bring you back in time to that moment, you know, let's say in 2015, where you were thinking about giving the notice at Microsoft. And let's say you were able to show up right in that moment where you're walking out of the building of Microsoft, and you're able to stop that younger guy and be able to get that younger guy to sit down for a coffee. And during that time, you're able to give that younger guy one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
I think I probably wouldn't have spoken to that guy. I wonder if anyone ever answered that. And the reason is, I think ignorance is a bliss. First of all, I think not knowing some of the challenges ahead is important to even be on a path. I think like initially when you just asked it, like I thought telling something like everything will be good, like continue on this path, do what you do. But I think even that overconfidence is not something that is good. Like you need to move in confidence, but you also need to be concerned with what may happen in other cases. So I think it's about balancing and looking back. You know, one of my favorite sentences is hindsight is always 20/20. Yes, there are small and different things we could have done differently along the path, but maybe we wouldn't have gotten to where we are. We would have done those things better or differently. And since I'm very happy with where we are, I would just like look from the side, be excited about that long journey that that guy is going to go through, and not say anything.
I love it. So, Guy, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
So I think LinkedIn is a great way to do so. And pretty responsive there. Yeah, that would be great.
Easy enough. Well, hey, Guy, well, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate having me.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.